Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Maria Casa, Director for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record. The audio file will be available on the CFR.org website within the next few days if you'd like to share it with any colleagues or classmates. We are delighted to have Max Boot with us today to discuss non-conventional warfare. Mr. Boot is CFR's Jean J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow for National Security Studies. He is also a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard and Los Angeles Times, and a regular contributor to the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Commentary, and other publications. Mr. Boot's newest book, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present, was released in January and immediately became a New York Times bestseller. The paperback version is now available. It came out this month. Mr. Boot has served as advisor to U.S. commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan, senior foreign policy advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign in 2007-2008, and defense policy advisor to Mitt Romney's campaign in 2011 and 2012. In 2004, Mr. Boot was named by the World Affairs Councils of America as one of the 500 most influential people in the United States in the field of foreign policy. You can follow him on Twitter at Max Boot. Welcome, Max. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe you could start us off by defining guerrilla or irregular warfare, commenting on how it has evolved through time, and explain why it is important for policymakers to understand its history.
Happy to do that. That's an easy setup for somebody who's written a lengthy book on the topic. Guerrilla warfare, irregular warfare, whatever you want to call it, is a lot like pornography. It's easier to know it than to define it. But essentially, it is basically everything other than the kind of conventional set-piece battles among uniformed militaries that have characterized wars such as World War II or the Gulf War. Guerrillas typically don't wear uniform, and they certainly don't stand in a line and battle their foes face-to-face. They are usually too weak to do that, and so they prefer to engage in stealth ambush to attack civilians or enemy forces and then escape as quickly as possible before they can suffer retribution at the hands of a superior conventional military. You know, we tend to think of this as being an aberration, something that, you know, perhaps started with Mao Zedong, or which has become especially prevalent since the end of the Cold War. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Irregular warfare is really the oldest form of warfare that there is. By comparison, conventional warfare is a relatively recent phenomenon. It only arose about 5,000 years ago when the very first city-states arose in Mesopotamia, because by definition, you can't have conventional armies without a state structure to support them, to provide the financing, the uniforms, the command and control structure, everything that we associate with conventional warfare. By contrast, guerrilla warfare has been going on as long as mankind has been on this earth, because tribal warfare is essentially guerrilla warfare. And even after you saw the rise of the first conventional armies around 3000 BC, one of their primary tasks, in fact, arguably the primary task, was not fighting other conventional armies, but fighting rebels within and nomadic raiders without. In other words, guerrillas. This has been the dominant challenge for every military power throughout history. It confronted the Roman legions. It confronts the U.S. Army today and everybody in between. So there's really nothing new about this kind of warfare. It's always been ubiquitous. It's always been the dominant form of warfare, which suggests that the very way that we think about these things, the terms that we use, unconventional, irregular, are backwards. What we call unconventional warfare is the norm. Conventional warfare, pitting two uniformed military forces against one another, is much rarer, as you can see from the fact that in the world today, while there are many conflicts going on, there is not a single conventional war going on. There have been ever fewer of those happening, but yet unconventional warfare continues in many countries, whether in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, or elsewhere, with the global battle against jihadist terrorists such as Al-Qaeda. That is front and center today, but it's really always been front and center. But now, by stressing the continuity in guerrilla warfare, I don't mean to suggest that nothing has changed over the centuries. There have been some big changes. And the biggest of all is really the growing importance of politics, propaganda, the press, what I call the three Ps, which is a relatively recent phenomenon, because prior to the, let's say, the 17th century, most guerrillas were nomadic raiders of the, like the Mongols or many others that bedeviled, settled agrarian civilizations from the dawn of the agricultural age. But starting in the, roughly the 18th century, rebels have been getting increasingly sophisticated, and they have been understanding that something that T. E. Lawrence said in the early 20th century, which is that the printing plant is the most powerful weapon in the armory of the guerrilla. And that's a change which in many ways occurred with our very own War of Independence. And we think about the American Revolution as having been won at battles like Saratoga and Yorktown. But the reality is that even after Cornwallis surrendered something like 7,000 British regulars to General Washington at the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, the British Empire still had ample resources to continue fighting. It still had tens of thousands of troops in North America and tens of thousands more it could have summoned from other parts of the empire. If our founding fathers had been fighting not the British Empire but the Roman Empire, I can assure you the story would not have had a happy ending. Washington, Jefferson, Adams, and all the rest would have wound up getting crucified, quite literally. The reason why it didn't happen in the present instance was because of a factor that the Roman Empire did not have to worry about: public opinion. The true turning point of the American Revolution was not a battle that occurred in North America, but rather a battle that occurred in the House of Commons in February of 1782, when the House, by a very narrow margin, voted to discontinue offensive operations in North America. This was a stinging blow to Lord North and his hardline Tory ministry. It led to the rise of Lord Rockingham and his Whigs, who were committed to a policy of conciliation with their American brethren. Now, it's hard to overstate just how revolutionary this development was, because here you had this great power, this superpower of its day, which had the capacity to continue fighting, but which chose not to do so because its public had turned against the war. This was not something that happened in centuries before. It has happened quite a few times in centuries since, in places like Vietnam or Iraq or today in Afghanistan, where public opinion has been the great equalizer for relatively puny insurgent forces battling much more powerful entities like the United States of America. And this helps to account for one of the interesting findings that I came up with in the course of my research, which is that insurgents are getting more successful. Their success rate has gone up. Prior to 1945, they were winning about 20% of completed insurgencies. Since 1945, they've been winning more than 40% of completed insurgencies. So there's a lot of reasons why that's the case, but I think the biggest really has to do with the power of public opinion, which is an issue not only for democracies like the United States, but even for dictatorships. I mean, just ask Muammar Gaddafi. Well, I'm sorry, you can't ask Gaddafi because he's not around. He's dead. But why is he dead? He was trying to do what dictators have been doing since the dawn of time, to put down an uprising by the sword. But he was unable to do that because the power of international public opinion mobilized against him and led to an intervention which resulted in his ouster and death. That's a sign of how powerful a weapon public opinion is and why the battlefield has shifted much more favorably towards insurgents today than was the case in centuries past. But, and this is my final point, we shouldn't go too far in the other direction and assume that insurgents are these 10-foot-tall superhumans who could not possibly be defeated by military force. That was a myth that became common after World War II, largely because of the success of a handful of high-profile insurgents like Mao or Ho Chi Minh. But the reality is, most insurgencies still lose. I mean, just remember the figure I cited a second ago. Even if insurgents are winning 40% of their campaigns since 1945, what's the flip side of that? They're still losing 60%. It's still possible to defeat insurgents. And, you know, we can talk about what the most successful strategies are, but essentially, it's some variant of the population-centric counterinsurgency strategy, which tries to combine carrots and sticks, that uses force against insurgents, but also tries to conciliate the vast bulk of the population, which may be undecided. This was the strategy that was employed in Iraq. It's been employed in Afghanistan, Colombia, Northern Ireland, and many other places. So, you know, that's if you're going to fight an insurgency, that's the way to do it. All right, with that, let me stop monologuing and engage in more of a back and forth.
Thank you, Max. There's a lot to talk about here. Let's open it up to the students for questions.
Okay, at this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Carnegie Mellon University.
Good afternoon, Mr. Boot. I'm Chris Landis at Carnegie Mellon University. I was wondering to what degree you would agree with the statement that cyber warfare is the newest component of irregular warfare, in that anyone from a 12-year-old to a more so-called professional organization like Anonymous to state-sponsored hacking and computer offensive activities can occur.
Well, I think there's some truth to that, but I think cyber war, like many weapons, is essentially neutral. It's like an AK-47, which can be utilized by conventional military or by an irregular insurgent-type force. We've certainly seen cyber war being used by states like the United States and Israel, for example, the Stuxnet virus designed to set back the Iranian nuclear program. But you're right, it has the potential to also be utilized by non-state actors. In fact, it is utilized by non-state actors today by many hackers, some of whom are engaged in criminal activity, others of whom are acting for political motives. And I suspect we will see a lot more of that in the future, because you're right, it is a kind of weapon which is very readily available. It doesn't require a lot of resources. All it requires is a basic knowledge of computer science, which many, many people around the world have. So it is a weapon that, while it can be used by states, is also tailor-made for insurgent forces battling states. And it is something that we need to be very, very worried about, because, you know, many of the enemies we face, even when they're groups like Al-Qaeda, they're not, they're not cavemen. They may have primitive religious beliefs, but they also have an understanding of modern technology and how to utilize it, which is very dangerous.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from the University of Kentucky.
Hi, Mr. Boot. Alexander Holmes, coach from the Patterson School. I was wondering, going forward, what do you think the focus should be for the United States military? Do you think fighting counterinsurgencies should be a primary focus, or do you think that should remain secondary to prosecuting more conventional wars?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's one that I think is in the process of being decided. My concern is that in the aftermath of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the military will revert to its comfort zone, which is conventional warfare. And you see that already with the Army and the Marine Corps being hit with major cutbacks, because people are assuming, well, we're never going to fight another major land war again. And the Air Force and the Navy are pushing for this pivot to the Pacific, because those two services don't have a very prominent role in fighting insurgents, and they want to emphasize the kind of battle where they would have primacy, which would be a conventional conflict against China. Now, I don't think we can ignore the growing Chinese threat. The fact that China is growing its defense budget by double digits amounts every year and is increasingly pushing around neighboring states, we need to be able to counter that to prevent a dangerous shift in the balance of power in the Western Pacific. But we also can't ignore what is our most immediate threat, which comes from insurgents. In fact, I think the greatest national security threat we face at the moment is the possibility of insurgents, of terrorists or guerrillas, getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction. That's a horrifying scenario. I mean, imagine if Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or some other such group got their hands on a nuclear weapon. That is our worst nightmare, and that's an indication of why we can't afford to ignore guerrilla warfare, why we can't make the mistake that we made after Vietnam, when the U.S. military turned its back on counterinsurgency and said, well, we're not going to do these kinds of wars. We're just going to prepare for the kind of wars that we want to fight. You know, it would be very nice if we faced more adversaries as cooperative as Saddam Hussein, who would put big tank armies out there in the desert so we can annihilate them using our high technology. But unfortunately, we've already done that a couple of times, and most of our adversaries have gotten the message this is not a very smart way to fight the United States of America. They understand that low-intensity tactics have a much higher probability of success, as we're learning once again in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so that's a guarantee we're going to be facing more of those kinds of tactics in the future.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Okay, again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question comes from Michigan State University.
Hi there. My name is Travis Caldwell. I go to Michigan State University, James Madison College. And my question is, looking at Afghanistan as a case study, do you think that the United States is falling into the same kind of pitfalls that the Soviets did in the 1980s, or are we transitioning to a different strategy using our high technology and taking the fight to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda?
Well, I don't think the biggest change between the United States and the Soviets is our high technology. I mean, I think the biggest difference is we have not been making war on the people of Afghanistan in the way that the Red Army did. I mean, they killed something like 1 million Afghans in the 1980s and fought in a very barbaric fashion, which our troops have not done. They have been, our forces have been very restrained, and I think advisedly so. In the 1980s, the Soviets managed to turn pretty much all of Afghan society against them. There were more than 100,000 Mujahideen fighting against the Red Army. Today, by contrast, while there is a very active insurgency, which, like the one in the 1980s, enjoys safe havens in Pakistan, it's much smaller. I mean, the estimates are today that the Taliban number perhaps 20,000 fighters. I mean, those are loose estimates, but it's still roughly a fifth the size of the insurgency that the Soviets faced in the 1980s. So our problems are not as severe, but we need to learn a lesson from the way that the Soviets pulled out, because immediately after they pulled out in 1989, they maintained funding for the Najibullah government. And as long as they maintained funding for that government, it was able to fight off the Mujahideen factions. But once the Soviet Union itself fell, funding for the government in Kabul was cut off. And so, and then in 1992, the Mujahideen were able to enter Kabul, and Najibullah wound up being strung up and hanging from a lamppost. That's a lesson we need to keep in mind today, because there's a big debate over how much support we're going to give to the government in Kabul after 2014. We need to maintain our funding for the Afghan security forces, and also, I think, maintain an advisory, a substantial advisory presence, as well as some counter-terrorist forces to enable them to hold off the Taliban and the Haqqani network and these other fighters. If we don't do that, the likely consequence would be what happened in the early 1990s, which is the rebels taking power and then possibly, at least in part of the country, and then possibly a major civil war erupting, which would be a terrible thing for Afghanistan as well as a terrible thing for our national security interests, because the Taliban have never disowned al-Qaeda. They still maintain close ties. And so if the Taliban came back into power in Afghanistan, you can bet that they would bring al-Qaeda with them.
Thank you, Max. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from the University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, Mr. Boot. My name is Zach Tan from the University of Pennsylvania. My question is that there has been a lot of talk lately that the counterinsurgency tactics that the U.S. Army has been using under the time of General Petraeus has slowly shifted to one of shadow warfare under the Obama administration, defined by, like, drone strikes or by cyber warfare. So what are your thoughts on this, and how effective will it be with dealing with a counterinsurgency threat?
Well, I think there's a good deal of truth in that. You know, President Obama came into office saying he wanted to end wars. Now, of course, you can't really end wars by edict or by one side taking action, but you can at least end your involvement in those wars. And so he pulled out of Iraq. Now, the result of that has not been the end of war, but rather the restarting of a war which had gone dormant, and the resurgence of al-Qaeda in Iraq since the departure of U.S. forces in 2000, at the end of 2011. But there's no question that with the downsizing in, with the departure in Iraq, the downsizing in Afghanistan, and President Obama's unwillingness to get more involved in Syria or elsewhere, that he doesn't want to commit ground forces and he doesn't want to rely as much as possible on drone strikes. Now, I'm ambivalent about drone strikes because I think there are limitations to what they can do, and we're seeing those limitations in places like Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia. I mean, drone strikes are basically a new tool of decapitation, a new way to take out terrorist leaders, which is well and good, and by doing that, you can keep them off balance. But what you can't do is really defeat an entrenched insurgent network simply by taking out a few leaders. What normally happens is the leaders get replaced. I mean, the Israelis have seen that. They've mounted many decapitation strikes over the years on Hamas and Hezbollah, and yet at the end of the day, Hamas and Hezbollah are stronger than ever. So there's major limitations on what you can do with drone strikes. At the same time, I don't think we can afford to discontinue drone strikes, because in areas like the frontier regions of Pakistan, they're truly the only tool that we have, because the local army is not doing an effective job of fighting these terrorist groups, so that if we're not taking out some of their leadership, they're not going to go away. They're going to solidify their control over those areas and use them as bases for expanding attacks, whether in their own country or neighboring countries or against us and our interests in the region. That's a prescription for a much more dangerous situation. So bottom line is, I have some reservations about this over-reliance on drones that we're seeing right now. I think it needs to be matched with a political strategy and a larger counterinsurgency strategy to roll back some of these terrorist networks. But at the same time, I don't think we can afford to discontinue these drone strikes, because I think that would make the situation worse, not better.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 at any time. Our next question comes from the University of Kentucky.
Hi, my name's Ben Mudd. I'm from UK's Paterson School of Diplomacy. And I know that you mentioned both the IRA and the American Revolution in your talk. And I was wondering what you would see as the conditions for a nation state acting against an insurgency for when they might be able to successfully reach a negotiated settlement with a insurgent organization instead of attempting to force a complete military victory?
Well, I think the best answer is one that was given to me a few years ago, by a NATO officer in Afghanistan. When I was during one of my visits there, I asked him, well, you know, what does it take to have successful negotiations with the Taliban? And his answer is, first we have to knock them on their butt, then we can offer them a helping hand up. And I think that's generally been the case, that insurgent groups will only negotiate and give up this armed struggle if they are convinced they cannot attain their objectives at gunpoint. That was the case, for example, with the Contras in Nicaragua, or the FMLN in El Salvador, or the IRA in Northern Ireland, or other groups that have put down their arms. It's not really the case right now with the Taliban in Afghanistan, as far as I can tell, because although they have suffered some setbacks since President Obama surged U.S. forces there in 2009-2010, the Taliban remain far from defeated, and they continue to have secure bases in Pakistan, which is one of the biggest indicators of success or failure for an insurgency, whether they have extraterritorial support, whether they have support in neighboring states. The Taliban do, and that makes it impossible or very difficult to apply decisive pressure on them. I don't think we've been able to do that, in part because we've signaled hesitation. We've put time limit. President Obama's put time limits on our surge. He's made clear we're about to leave. And so that basically encourages the Taliban to run out the clock and to expect that after 2014, they will have more success in attaining their objectives. I mean, I think President Obama didn't really understand how to initiate successful negotiations with the Taliban, because that's clearly his goal. But, you know, by signaling that we're about to leave, that makes it very unlikely that the Taliban will negotiate in good faith or make real concessions. And, you know, that's where we are today. You know, I think in general, in order to have success negotiating, unless you're negotiating your own surrender, you basically have to win some victories in the field, and you have to convince the other side they're not going to win by force. Now, that hasn't happened in Afghanistan. It may have happened in Colombia. We'll have to see, where the FARC there has been negotiating to end an insurgency, which has been going on since the mid-1960s. It's still not clear if they're going to make the concessions necessary, but, you know, they've suffered much more severe defeats over the last 10 years than the Taliban have, and so I think they're much more likely to agree to a negotiated end to the conflict.
Thank you, Max. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from the University of College in Dublin.
Oh, yes. I'd like to ask, can you give a good example of a larger state defeating an insurgent movement, and what lessons can be learned from that? Like, how can we do it? What is the best way for the United States to do that?
Well, there's many examples of large state beating insurgent movements, most of them, you know, in their own frontiers. I mean, if you look, for example, since the mid-1960s, many states in Western Europe and the United States, in North America, faced small-scale terrorist movements. You know, the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Red Brigades, the IRA, the Japanese Red Army, the Weathermen, the Weather Underground in the United States. None of those were successful. I mean, and truthfully, none of those was a major threat to the security of the state, except possibly, you know, ethnic or nationalist movements like the IRA. And, you know, the reason why none of those other terrorist groups got very far was because they were fighting states that had a base of legitimacy among the population that they simply could not shake. When you have states that are relatively effective and, you know, can deliver results for the population and are popularly elected, that have popular support at any rate, it's very hard for those kinds of governments to be shaken by force. And which is, and in turn, if you do, any state out there, no matter what, and it's generally only weak states that face entrenched insurgencies, but whatever kind of state you are, you have to think about not just how do you capture or kill insurgents, but how do you increase your level of legitimacy with the population so as to take away the support that the insurgents have. I mean, that's That's the core task, and that's something that, you know, I think Britain accomplished in the case of the IRA. That's something that I think the Colombian government, initially under the inspired leadership of President Alvaro Uribe, has accomplished in Colombia over the last 10 years. And it's, you know, the strategy is pretty simple. It's been classic examples of it include, you know, the strategy that was employed by the British in Malaya in the early 1950s, or by the Filipino government at the same time against the Hook or communist uprising in the Philippines. And basically, it's first you got to deliver security, because security is the number one job for any government. You know, even at home, you expect the government to protect you from crooks, from disorder. So you got to deliver security, and it's impossible to do that with airstrikes or with artillery. You got to do it by having soldiers, or preferably police, who are out there on the ground 24/7 protecting the population. And once you do that, you can hope to get cooperation from the population to acquire intelligence to tell you who are the insurgents lurking in their midst, who are these invisible armies, so you can bring them out into the open and then capture or kill them. But, you know, the trick is to get that cooperation. And the key, as I said, is security, but you also have to have some legitimacy. You have to have some positive reason why the people should support you, and some hope that by supporting the government, they will have a better life than they would if they were supporting the insurgency. So that's, I mean, that's the key. It's you know, you have to provide bottom line security and legitimacy. That's the winning strategy. That's really at the heart of what is often called hearts and minds, or population-centric counterinsurgency. But of course, it's easy for me to stand here and talk about that. It's much harder to go out there and implement it, especially in countries like Iraq or Afghanistan, which have, you know, very little governance, have, and the governments have very little legitimacy. There's very little security. It's very, very hard to go from a very low base to achieve the level of security and legitimacy you need. It's much easier in countries, you know, like in Western Europe or other developed parts of the world, where you already have a very high degree of security and legitimacy. It doesn't take that much to stop an insurgent group under those circumstances.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Florida University. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and go on to the next question. The next question comes from the U.S. Military Academy.
Hi, I'm Cadet Jacob Swatley from the United States Military Academy. My question deals with regionally aligned forces. You know, in the Army, they're trying to implement the program where they regionally align conventional forces. What effect, if any, do you think this will have on future irregular warfare situations the United States might find themselves in? And what do you think of conventional forces kind of starting to share this mission more so with special operations forces, sharing it more than they have in recent decades?
Well, there's no question that conventional forces, especially ground forces, have to be prepared for unconventional conflict. They don't have the luxury of saying that's just a special operations mission, we're not going to worry about it. That doesn't work out. I mean, we've seen that in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan. There's not enough special operations forces to go around. But even if you're not engaged in these major ground wars, then we're probably not going to be engaged in another major ground war anytime soon, although we could be. You never know. But even if we're not, there's still going to be too many demands on special operations forces, and there's always going to be a push to move the special operations community where they are today, which is very heavily oriented on the direct action piece of, you know, capturing or killing individuals. But a lot of what has to be done is much more indirect, and really building up host nation capacity and trying to assist them in some of the tasks where they're in the lead and fighting our mutual enemies. So, you know, I think the regular forces, the big army, if you will, is going to have a major role to play in that. Now, I'm not convinced that these regionally aligned brigades are going to do that much good, because I'm sort of skeptical about how much regional knowledge and how much language knowledge in particular they're actually going to have, because, you know, as I'm sure you know, as somebody, you know, even as a cadet, I'm sure you're familiar with the formidable array of training tasks and jobs that any brigade out there is going to have, which leaves very little time for acquiring the kind of cultural and language knowledge you need to be effective in these very alien societies. I've been in favor of a different proposal, one which has not found favor with the Army leadership, a proposal that was put forward a few years ago by John Nago, who's a now retired officer and counterinsurgency strategist, who argued that we needed a big advisory organization within the regular Army, a division-sized, let's say, organization where that would be made up of people who train especially for advisory missions of largely officers and NCOs. You don't need a lot of enlisted personnel in that kind of assignment, but you do need people who have experience, who have competence, who have language and cultural knowledge, and can focus on those tasks. Whereas today, the pattern is much more of trying to take advisors who are essential personnel out of existing combat formations. And if you do that, if you take good personnel out of those existing combat formations, you will severely degrade their combat effectiveness, or else you wind up taking them out of reserve or National Guard or combat support or you know, back office type functions, where the people you're getting are not necessarily of the caliber you need to be effective advisors. So this is a mission which has really been an orphan within the U.S. military, advising foreign militaries, and yet in many ways, it's one of the most important missions we have. And I don't think these regionally aligned brigades are going to truly address that issue. I think an advisory organization might well be the way to go, but it would involve a more radical reorganization than what the Army leadership is comfortable with.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Okay, our next question comes from Bush School of Government and Public Service.
Hi, this is Joe Cerami. I'm on the faculty at the Bush School. Several years ago, there was a lot of discussion in D.C. about the three Ds, defense, development, diplomacy. Robert Gates talked about it quite a bit, and Hillary Clinton, et cetera. I was wondering if that concept serves at all as a framework for your thinking, and is it, Did you find it in your history? I apologize, I haven't had the chance to read your book yet, but I'm curious as to whether or not that, as an organizing principle for the U.S. government's role in these insurgency situations, makes any sense or not.
The three Ds are defense, diplomacy. What's the third one?
Development.
Development. Yeah, I mean, obviously, those are all important tasks. I think that the challenge that we face as a country is we're much better at the defense piece of that, i.e. kinetic military action, than we are about the other two. And, you know, a few years ago in Afghanistan, there was a lot of hullabaloo about a civilian surge and how we were going to have lots of experts pushed out to PRTs, the provincial reconstruction teams, working on supporting our troops in the field. Well, very little of that actually occurred, to the extent that State Department personnel were actually sent to Afghanistan. Most of them wound up in the heavily fortified embassy in Kabul. Very few of them got out into the field, and those who did tended not to be regular Foreign Service officers. They tended to be contract hires, because most of the regular Foreign Service officers are not very interested in that kind of mission. And I think that's a problem we're going to continue to confront, because there is a gap in our U.S. government capabilities. We can do diplomacy, and that's a valuable thing to do. And we can do defense, you know, basically killing people and breaking things. We know how to do those two things. But what we really lack is a capacity for nation building. I guess that would be the development piece of it. But it shouldn't be development seen as economic development. I think it really has to be development seen as political, as governmental development. The ability to develop institutions that are seen as legitimate and are capable of controlling their own territory. I mean, in many ways, this is the central issue that we face today, because the reason why Al-Qaeda has been gaining traction in countries like Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Mali, and many others is because those countries lack institutions that work. And our challenge is to build up those institutions without sending hundreds of thousands of American troops on the ground. But we don't have any agency in our government which actually looks at that as their mission. I mean, you've got the State Department, which is really focused on a diplomatic function with other, and really as a liaison service with other governments around the world and in countries where the government actually works. You've got the U.S. Agency for International Development, but it has very few resources, and it really looks upon itself as having this kind of nebulous mission for economic development. It doesn't see itself as being the shock troops of nation building, which, in fact, I think is how we ought to see it. Now, my proposal is we need to ramp up AID, and we need to transform it. And the best way to do that would be to take some of these troops who served in Afghanistan and Iraq over the last decade, who have acquired tremendous expertise and competence in counterinsurgency warfare, but are now about to be out of a job because we're downsizing the Army and the Marine Corps and the rest of the military. Take some of these troops who've been out there and know what it takes and give them new jobs at AID and send them out there to foster better governance in some of these chaotic countries where we have a strategic interest in preventing terrorist groups from making inroads. That's what I think we need to do to bolster the development piece, which I think is crucial to any successful counterterrorist strategy.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Kevlar Stockton College.
Hey, this is Santiago Leite from Culver Stockton College. I was just wondering, you mentioned that unconventional warfare is more efficient than conventional warfare. I was just wondering, what type of like surveillance techniques it uses, and how do you think like warfare will be like in the future?
Well, I'm not sure I would say that unconventional warfare is more efficient. All I said was that it was more common. You know, nobody really chooses unconventional warfare if they can help it, because it's a very difficult way to fight. It involves a lot of hardship and pain. And so if you can field conventional military forces, anybody who has the option would do that. But the reason why people use unconventional warfare is because they don't have the resources of a state. They don't have the capacity to field regular armies. And so this is how they are forced to fight. It's essentially the war of the weak. You know, and that's going to continue in the future. I don't really know what the future will bring, but the trends are ominous, because one of the big trends of the last 100 years is there is more and more destructive power at the hands of the individual. A century ago, when Western armies were fighting against guerrillas, like, let's say, the North American Indians, they were facing adversaries who were usually armed with nothing more than bows and arrows and maybe a few rifles. Today, of course, there is no corner of the world so remote that every young man doesn't have access to an AK-47, a rocket-repelled grenade, explosives, all these relatively simple, low-tech infantry weapons that have nevertheless taken a terrible toll among our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And unfortunately, insurgents are becoming better armed all the time. You saw in the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah how Hezbollah used an anti-ship missile to seriously damage an Israeli warship off the coast of Lebanon. You saw how Hezbollah also used anti-tank missiles to slow down the Israeli offensive into southern Lebanon. I suspect you're going to see a lot more of that in the future as ever more effective weaponry falls into the hands of insurgent groups. And, you know, of course, the ultimate nightmare, as I mentioned earlier, is that they could someday get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. You know, for example, the chemical weapons, which are hopefully being destroyed now in Syria, but I doubt they'll get them all, or nuclear weapons, which Iran is trying to develop, or, you know, even very different kinds of weapons of mass destruction, such as biological weapons or potentially even cyber weapons, could theoretically be weapons of mass destruction if they're employed in the right way. I mean, that's my concern for the future, is that you're going to see these super empowered guerrillas. And you mentioned, the last part of your question was, you mentioned surveillance techniques, and I think it is incredibly important that we maintain surveillance of these groups and their sympathizers. We don't do a very good job as a country at human intelligence. We don't do a good job of sending agents to penetrate Al-Qaeda or other such organizations. One of the few advantages we have are the very powerful surveillance technologies created by the technological whizzes at the National Security Agency, which allow us to keep track of electronic communications among various people who might be plotting to do us harm. And I've been very dismayed to see the way that Edward Snowden has revealed some of our very classified surveillance capabilities. I hope that despite the resulting furor, that we will maintain, keep on doing what we're doing, because there has been no indication that the NSA's capabilities have been abused for personal or political gain or anything like that. But there is a lot of evidence that they have been very important in breaking up terrorist plots and keeping us safe. And so I hope that despite all the criticism being directed its way, that the NSA can continue doing what it's doing, which is essentially keeping us safe from a growing threat.
Thank you, Max. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Carnegie Mellon University.
Hey, Mr. Boot. My name is James, and my question actually has to do with the development of political institutions. So in rhetoric, the American government has always been a supporter for democratic regimes, but in practice over the last couple of decades, it's been a proven fact that the United States helped overthrow legitimate governments. So by overthrowing those governments, a lot of the public opinion of those countries sway against us. So how can the American government now try to regain the trust of the people of those countries so that we could increase our national security?
Which legitimate governments have we overthrown?
Well, I mean, we've overthrown a democratically elected government in Iran, in Cuba, in Chile. So, I mean, we've done a lot of things in the interest of our own national security that might have damaged our trust with the citizens in those countries.
Okay, I'm not even aware of us overthrowing any elected government in Cuba. In the case of Chile and in Iran, it's arguable, but I think it's an exaggeration of the CIA role to say that the CIA overthrew the governments in those particular countries. I think what the CIA did was it gave some support to local people who wanted to overthrow regimes, whether it was the Shah in Iran or Pinochet in Chile. But I don't think it was a case of the United States snapping our fingers and suddenly making these governments disappear. I think it was they really fell because there was a lot of local discontent, which was the primary driving force behind the overthrow of those governments. I think in many ways our ideals are actually compromised less by overthrowing elected governments than by cooperating with dictatorial governments, which we do all the time in countries like Saudi Arabia. Many of our allies are not democratic. And, you know, we've tended to look the other way at some of their human rights abuses. It's a balancing act here because you don't want to cut off ties with a friendly dictatorship only to see it be replaced by an unfriendly dictatorship, which is what happened in Iran in 1979, where we cut off the Shah and, you know, he was overthrown and the result was the rise of an Islamic revolution, which is even more illiberal than the Shah and certainly more hostile to the United States. But at the same time, I don't think we can just give a blank check indefinitely to these dictatorships because, you know, I think you're right that if we're associated with unpopular governments, that creates hatred and resentment of the United States, which has happened across a lot of the Middle East, in particular in Egypt, where Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current head of Al-Qaeda, is an Egyptian and, you know, got his start in politics by fighting against an unpopular Mubarak regime that we supported right up until the end. I've long felt that was a mistake, that we should do more to push for more openness, for more space for political dissent so that you don't face this terrible choice, which we now face today in Egypt, between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood, two essentially illiberal, anti-democratic forces. There's really no good choice between them. You know, I think we should do much more to try to foster a more moderate opposition, but it's hard to do in these regimes because, you know, in places like Saudi Arabia, the Saudis tell us that we need them for security reasons, and they're right. And so we've done very little to try to push them on the issue of human rights, but I think it is something that we do need to work on, because if we don't, it will ultimately undermine the stability of those regimes and our own security.
Thank you, Max. Next question, please.
Okay, again, to ask a question, please press star 1 at any time. Our next question comes from Michigan State University.
Hi, sir. This is Eric Mauman from Michigan State University, James Madison College. My question refers to a comment you made towards the beginning of this phone conversation about the Air Force and the Navy as forces generally more tailored to fighting conventional wars. Do you believe there's a way for these forces to adapt to fighting this irregular style of warfare, or do they just continue to support the ground forces?
I think their primary job in unconventional warfare is to support the ground forces because, you know, the Air Force and the Navy are basically high-technology standoff forces which can deliver munitions on target, but that's really not the challenge in an unconventional war. The challenge is not to annihilate the enemy, it's to identify the enemy. And, you know, part of that has a technological answer, but most of it really has to do with human intelligence and with acquiring the kind of local awareness of what's going on that you can only acquire by actually being there. And, of course, you know, some Navy and Air Force personnel have been on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan performing functions similar to those of the ground troops, but that obviously is not the core of their mission, and nor should it be. I mean, there is a legitimate reason why we need an Air Force and Navy configured primarily for high-end conventional threats, because those threats have not gone away. We do need to prepare for them. In particular, we do need to deter China from aggression, and that is a totally legitimate mission. I am by no means saying that we should retool the Navy and Air Force into primarily counterinsurgency services. I think there's a natural division of labor where the Army and Marine Corps focus more on those counterinsurgency-type tasks, whereas the Navy and Air Force focus more on the high end of warfare. And so, of course, when you're fighting an insurgency, the Air Force and Navy feel sidelined, as was the case over the last decade, whereas today, when we're getting out of I don't know if we're going to do it successfully, but we hope we're getting out of the counterinsurgency fighting business. The Air Force and Navy are coming more to the fore, and the Army and Marine Corps are feeling a little bit sidelined. In reality, I think we need to keep both of those capabilities because, like other superpowers, we face a wide range of threats, and the only guarantee is that whatever threat we're not ready to face is the one we will face because our enemies understand our strengths and weaknesses.
Next question, please.
Okay. Our next question comes from Thoreau College.
Yeah, Mr. Booth, this is Ben Lunzer. I'm the faculty at Thoreau College. Question is, the way that you're describing it, it almost as if all insurgencies are equal, and yet I assume that they're motivated by different purposes with different goals. And wouldn't we want to have different responses or different approaches depending on whether the insurgency is in Afghanistan or South America or perhaps Africa?
Well, there's no question that insurgency is the most context-specific kind of warfare, and there are certainly general principles you can apply against any insurgency, but in terms of how you actually go about defeating them, a lot of what is necessary is knowledge of conditions on the ground, and it's not just general knowledge of what Afghanistan is like. It's really knowledge of what Village X is why and how it differs from Village Y 5 miles down the road. It really takes a very hard to acquire understanding of local conditions in order to be successful in this type of conflict. And, you know, that's one of the weaknesses that we face, because our troops and our diplomatic and intelligence personnel usually don't have that kind of local knowledge, don't have that kind of language knowledge, and they often don't have time to acquire it because we're rotating people through these countries all the time. That's why I think it's important to leave some people who are there for the long term, for more than a year at a time, who spend years in a particular place and really learn and understand what's going on there. And it's also important, I think, to be able to recruit foreigners, people who already have that kind of local knowledge and are interested in serving on behalf of the United States and on behalf of our general fight for freedom. I think we need to loosen up the rules, which we've done a little bit. There was an experiment in the last couple of years with allowing some non-citizens and non-green card holders to sign up for the military, and the result is we've gotten some outstanding troops, including a couple who have been won honors as Soldier of the Year. But I think we need to do more of that, expand our ability to recruit non-Americans, because the asset which we lack the most in this kind of warfare is not smart bombs or predators or other sophisticated high-end technology. What we lack most is knowledge of language and culture, and that's a gap that we need to fill.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Max. Why don't we close with this last question from me? I'd like to know what inspired you to write Invisible Armies.
Well, my inspiration was really from spending time over the last decade traveling in Iraq and Afghanistan and seeing the wars unfold there in real time. It really made me curious about how different or not what I was seeing was from the historical norm. What were the origins of this kind of conflict? What was the history of this kind of conflict? I mean, I had some vague ideas, but I didn't really know the story. And so even as I was traveling to and writing about Iraq and Afghanistan in 2006, I began the process of historical research to try to put what I was seeing in a broader historical context, and that was not easy to do. There was a lot of reading and writing that had to be done, but about 6 years later, I finally emerged with a manuscript that I think shows what's changed and what hasn't changed over the centuries in this type of conflict and why we need to be concerned about this type of warfare even after we're out of Iraq and Afghanistan, why it's a continuing challenge and why it's always been around and will always be around, and how various countries, including our own, have struggled to deal with this type of warfare. There was a very rich story there, and you know, the more I researched, the more I found, and what really pushed me along to complete this six-year project was really finding these amazing, colorful characters like Giuseppe Garibaldi or Ward Wingate, T. Lawrence, Mao Zedong, Che Guevara, or many others, who are some of the outstanding insurgents and counterinsurgents throughout history. I really tried to make the book as readable as possible and to build it around the stories of these individuals because, you know, insurgency and counterinsurgency is not some impersonal kind of standoff conflict. It's up close and personal. And it really depends on outstanding personalities on both sides in order to have any success. And so I tried to tell this very rich and very interesting story with this book.
Well, it is indeed a fascinating book and so thoroughly treated. I hope everybody has a chance to read it. Max, thank you for sharing your insights with us today, and thanks to all of you across the country and abroad for your interesting questions and comments. Our next call will take place on Tuesday, November 6th, when Richard Haass, president of CFR, will discuss American Grand Strategy. In the meantime, we hope you will follow CFR's academic initiative on Twitter at CFR_academic for information on new CFR resources and upcoming events. I would also like to announce that we recently launched a dedicated students' homepage where you can find information on calls and events, current CFR resources well-suited for research, and more. The URL is cfr.org/students. So thank you again for your participation today, and we look forward to your continued participation in CFR Academic Conference Call.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.